Mr. Milbourne, the appellant, and if the court pleases, I'd like to reserve at least a minute to a minute and a half of rebuttal time. This court's aware of the fact that there are two certified issues before the court. The two certified issues are substantive claims of constitutional error, one claim sounding under Doyle versus Ohio, the other claim sounding under Darden versus Wainwright, Donnelly. Both prosecutorial misconduct claims. The first one dealing with the prosecutor's inappropriate impeachment or introduction of evidence of Mr. Milbourne's constitutional right to invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination and ask for an attorney.
Well, he actually talked after that, didn't he? I mean, he volunteered some information.
Voluntary statements well after that. Probably, you know, the record isn't real clear on that, but it was on the ride from Laughlin to Las Vegas, so it was probably 2 or 3 hours after he invoked.
So really, what's the harm in the question? The prosecutor didn't actually comment on his failure to give a statement or anything like that.
The prosecutor didn't make a comment on that in closing argument. What the prosecutor did in Doyle was introduced evidence of it, brought it in through the arresting officer's testimony. Officer Pritchett testified that I Mirandized him. He invoked his right to remain silent. He wanted an attorney. That's how the evidence came out. The evidence came out in the prosecutor's case in chief during the direct testimony. The other
Doyle didn't have a situation where the guy volunteered some information later, did it?
Doyle did not. The case in Doyle was that the two defendants testified that the confidential informant had been indeed the seller of the drugs. They weren't the seller of the drugs. And what the prosecutor did with impeachment was say, well, why didn't you tell all of this information to the police? If it was exculpatory information, you should have done that. And that was the Doyle error. So really, there
no comment in the closing argument in Doyle.
I'm not sure if there was in Doyle. In this case, there was no comment.
I thought there was in Doyle.
There may have been. And in this case, the trial judge during the motion for mistrial that was conducted outside the presence of the jury admonished the prosecutor not to say anything. The trial judge did mention the fact that it was a concern that this evidence did come in. But
so basically, counsel, on this comment, then we have concern about one answer from a police officer in the course of a fairly lengthy trial.
Right. Yes.
In which there seems to be quite a bit of evidence. You've argued that it was weak and circumstantial. It was circumstantial, but it does seem to be quite a bit of evidence.
Right. And I wanted to talk about that, obviously, because before I do get to the Brecht analysis, I think that, you know, this is not just the Doyle error. There's also what I would consider the very compelling error that this court addressed many years ago in Standen versus Whitley, and that's commenting on plea negotiations. And this isn't as compelling as the Standen case, where in Mr. Standen's trial, the state introduced evidence of the fact that he had pled guilty and withdrew that plea. In this case, in Mr. Milbourne's case, the state introduced evidence during Mr. Milbourne's cross-examination that Mr. Milbourne had tried to get some plea negotiations going. He said, I want to plead guilty. I want to get this thing over with. They brought it in through Milbourne's cross-examination, and then if that wasn't bad enough, they, in their rebuttal case, they called the correctional officer to talk about how Mr. Milbourne wanted to conduct these plea negotiations because he wanted to get his glasses. I mean, it was really kind of tragic because he'd been sitting in the county jail for 10 months, and he was just kind of losing it. He said, you know, I got to get out of here.
What's your best Supreme Court precedent to say that that's an unconstitutional practice?
Well, I think in Standen, this court cited Kercheval, United States versus, I think it's United States versus Kercheval, and it's a due process violation where, you know, in the Standen case, I don't mean to submit that this case is on point with Standen. It's not, but we're talking about, you know, the attempt to get to make discussions with regard to plea negotiations.
Most of the error in that would be where the defendant is in court with his lawyer, or they were in negotiations with the prosecution. That wasn't the situation here at all, was it? He was just talking to somebody at the prison or jail.
Officer. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily, the plea negotiations discussions don't need to be in court. They could be at a coffee shop or at the prosecution.
Yeah, it's with his counsel or with opposing counsels, not with a guard or a guy down the street or somebody who's a police officer.
Right. Yeah, I don't mean to suggest that this is directly on point with Standen, but it certainly was presented as constitutional to the Nevada Supreme Court.
Counsel, if he'd been talking to a prison guard and had said, "Yeah, I did it. I dumped his body down a mine shaft," would that be admissible in court?
Well, it depends on the circumstances. I think if to take your hypothetical
Well, he's been sitting in the jail for 10 months. He's been given the Miranda warnings. He has an attorney, but he's talking with a jailer who's not asking him any questions, and he just says it.
Right. I think under those circumstances, if indeed a court that heard all of the evidence surrounding what your hypothetical concluded that the statement was voluntary, then it would be admissible.
And if he says to
confidential informant or the guard was playing him,
if the guard's been planted there and trying to get whatever information he can, but that doesn't seem to be our situation here. Now, if he says to the guard, "Call my lawyer because I dumped his body down a mine shaft and I want to talk to him," would that then be admissible?
Obviously, my knee-jerk reaction would be that it's not admissible because it's conditioned with the "call my lawyer," you know.
Yeah, but that's not the guard's fault.
Well, it's not the guard's fault.
It hasn't been prompted by anything.
Absolutely, and of course, we're not, you know, I mean,
That brings us then to the third question, of course, is what happens when he says to the guard, "Call my lawyer, I want to plead guilty."
Right, and I see, to me, I want to plead guilty is the ultimate sanction. What he's saying is, at that point, unlike your inculpatory statement, which I think is more colored by a Fifth Amendment question and whether or not there is indeed still a retained Sixth Amendment right to counsel when that statement's made, I think when the defendant says, "I want to plead guilty," all sorts of alarms go off, because what the defendant is then saying is, you know, "I'm not just incriminating myself, but I want to waive the entire panoply of constitutional rights that I have, the right to confront witnesses, the right to present witnesses, the right to counsel, to certain extents the right to appeal." That's a bigger deal, I think, than making an inculpatory statement, because it's colored by, you know, at least a lot, you know, again, borrowing on the Standen case and Kirchhoff, which I believe is a very old case, a lot of precedent, jurisprudence from the United States Supreme Court that you just can't get into that statement. That statement is just, you know, verboten. It's something that it can be deemed harmless. I'm not saying that it's structural error,
Why don't we turn to the question then of whether this is harmless error, and tell us, put this in context for us as to why these two statements so undermine our confidence in the result here that we ought to overturn it.
I think that really the way we get to that point is that we have nothing to defer to, so really the epideference standard is not necessarily in play. I think this is very, very close to what this court was dealing with in the Intivong case. There was dicta in Intivong that said that if the highest state court does not conduct a harmless error analysis, which the Nevada Supreme Court did not do, they just dropped the footnote saying we've reviewed all these other issues and find them to be without merit. The two of those issues were the two constitutional errors we've been discussing. So what we're talking about is Brecht error. Is that error in singularly or in combination? Does that error, in this court's opinion, did it have a substantial and injurious effect on any one of the jurors' decisions to vote for guilt? And it's not a Jackson versus Virginia analysis. It's not, was there sufficient evidence to support the guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? That's not what we're talking about. And I kind of like to compare it to, you know, if you're making, I don't know, I was trying to think of a good way to do this. If you're making some spaghetti sauce and you drop bleach into it, you know, that's going to ruin the entire sauce. And that's what happened here. You have a trial. You drop air into it that ruins the entire trial.
Well, that's a pretty fantastic analogy.
Well, I think
look at the hard evidence against him, which I think there was plenty.
Well, it depends on, there was plenty, but it was circumstantial.
Sure, what's wrong with that? That's
compelling circumstantial evidence came from the pathologist who was all over the board. The pathologist could not give a time of death that made any sense medically, and he basically admitted that on cross-examination.
Did my client pretend the victim was still alive?
Well, according to my client's...
After his body had already been found.
Well, and again, according to my client's testimony, he was getting that information from this Brian guy that he met with the victim.
But, I mean, it was a story that really rebounded against him.
But if you look at his conduct after this all happened, it wasn't the kind of conduct of somebody who was trying to hide his guilt. He went to California. He remodeled the Jeep the way that that Rushford wanted him to remodel it. He drove it. He didn't change the license plate. He wrote checks, leaving Rushford's on basically with Rushford's license plate as collateral and security, charged on Rushford's charge account. This was not a guy that was heading to Argentina to get away from a murder that he had committed. His conduct was completely innocent. But I think if you go right back to what the pathologist testified to, the time of death could have been anywhere from 24 and maybe even more, 30 hours prior to finding the body at 3:30 on June 2nd, to as little as, and this was the defendant's theory in closing argument, was that given the circumstantial evidence that was available at the scene, the fact that there was the hood from the truck had been seen leaning against the truck at noon by Mrs. Seaton, was dragged, and then at 3:30, the hood that was leaning against the truck was covering the body. The fact that there was fresh blood, red blood, at the scene underneath Mr. Rushford's body. The fact that the rigor mortis and the livor mortis that had set in was all indicative of death having occurred within a short period of time from finding the body leads to an absolute alibi for Mr. Milbourne. Because Mr. Milbourne, from at least 9 o'clock the night before until 6 p.m. the day they discovered the body, was in the presence of Mary Kane. And Mary Kane, the state's own witness, testified to that, and she said that she and Milbourne did not leave each other for more than 20 minutes that entire period of time. And if that's the case, again, by the state's own testimony, by the state's own evidence, Milbourne couldn't have driven from Laughlin to the scene of the crime, which was an hour and a half drive. So if indeed, again, the evidence is circumstantial, and I admit, Judge Noonan, that you can convict with circumstantial evidence, but not with this circumstantial evidence. This circumstantial evidence was all over the board, and the state's theory of the case, and was mentioned in opposing counsel's brief, was that the window of opportunity for the death was that period of time based upon Dr. Clark's testimony, and that window of opportunity had to, in order for that window of opportunity to be at all evidentiary. To have any valid evidentiary value, that you had to take as unequivocal medical testimony Dr. Clark's theory that Mr. Rushford was killed 24 hours before finding him. And I just couldn't, I mean, it just, by his own admission, if you read cross-examination of Dr. Clark, in several places he talks about it being just a rough estimate. Well, a rough estimate. We're talking about a man who's doing two life without sentences based on this rough estimate. He also says that, it's possible. He essentially concedes that the death could have occurred within 12 hours of having found the body. Now, if that's the case, if you find the body at 3:30 on June 2nd, and you go back in time 12 hours, that's 3:30 in the morning that same day, Milbourne is with Mrs. Kane. He slept with her. They slept together. Again, to read Mrs. Kane's testimony. It's at excerpts of record 137 to 168. They did not separate for more than 20 minutes. That just doesn't square with the state's window of opportunity theory, because Milbourne would have had a rock solid alibi. And that's why, you know, that's my analogy, and maybe it's a little over the top, but, you know, this is not a situation where, you know, this is error. I mean, there's particularly the jury hearing evidence that he was ready to plead guilty. You know, I mean, that's pretty bad. As this court said in Standen, it doesn't get any worse than that. And again, you know,
Counsel, what do we do? For example, I'm looking at page 22 of the state's brief. Milbourne actually signed a note. It was Exhibit 81, showing that Milbourne had met with the victim and obtained a sample of cocaine on June 5th. Body had already been found on June 3rd.
Right. And I think, and again, Milbourne testified about that note. He was definitely cross-examined about that note. And his testimony was, they just gave me this thing and I signed it. But what I was trying to explain to them, and again, this was his testimony, was that I was getting this information from this fellow named Brian.
Who was that fellow?
I'm sorry?
Who was this fellow giving him? Who was that fellow that you're referring to?
Brian was the guy who came down from Reno with Michael Rushford, who Milbourne...
Were identified further?
No, he was not identified further by...
Did he appear at the trial?
No, he did not. He was...
And his imagination?
Well, judge, but that's...
Well, I mean, that's sort of a common sense of reaction to that kind of story.
Well, again, it was what happened. It was what Mr. Milbourne...
What he said happened, yeah.
Well, exactly. It's what Mr. Milbourne's testimony was, and again, in response to your question, Judge Bybee, that was Mr. Milbourne's explanation.
Yeah, I mean, he's driving his car. He's got his credit cards. He's lying about having seen him. He's creating an effective alibi by calling Rushford's brother and asking him if he's seen him. I mean, these are ways in which somebody who's committed a murder might very plausibly be covering it up.
Well, and again, that was the state's theory. But my response to that is Richard Milbourne waived his Fifth Amendment right, took the stand, and tried to explain that. He got on the stand. He tried to make as best an explanation as he could for that.
You say it was the state's theory. It was what the jury heard and decided your client was lying.
And they could have just made it, they could have made that decision based on the fact that the state introduced evidence that he wanted to plead guilty. I mean, what are we spending all this time for if the guy wants to plead guilty? You know, to me, that's Brecht error.
In that Standen case, did the defendant make a statement to a prison guard?
Standen, like I said, Standen, again, I don't mean to suggest that Standen is directly on point. I want to make that perfectly clear. In Standen's case, Mr. Standen pled guilty. He got the guilty plea set aside because it was not voluntarily.
Something he did in court, right?
Yes. Okay. And at the trial, the state introduced the fact that he pled guilty. Yeah.
Right, I felt.
Right. Unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve my time.
Okay. Let's hear from the state.
If it pleases the court, my name is David Neidert. I'm a senior deputy attorney general for the state of Nevada. I think looking at the two issues that have been presented, first of all, there's a real question, and I think it's first to need to be addressed. The district judge sort of skirted right by it as to whether there was Doyle error at all. The district court said, well, assuming there was Doyle error, he can't survive Brecht given the strength of the state's case against Mr. Milbourne. The problem with saying that there was, in fact, Doyle error has to do with language that Justice Stevens, writing several years later in the case of Wainwright versus Greenfield, wrote that what is impermissible is the evidentiary use of an individual's constitutional rights to remain silent or consult with counsel. There was no evidentiary use of this. What there was the elicitation from the highway patrol officer that arrested Mr. Milbourne, that he's read him his rights, Mr. Milbourne invoked, and that later on Mr. Milbourne started talking and made statements that were exculpatory towards himself. I'm not going to defend the prosecutor for the artfulness of what was how he went about it, but basically he
shouldn't have done it.
I don't think he should have done it.
You're just saying it's.
But I'm not saying it's, I'm saying it's not Doyle error. I'm saying that the judge was very, very correct in admonishing the prosecutor, don't do that, move away from that area, and at the same time not declaring a mistrial.
Motion for a mistrial requested.
Well, I think there was. The problem, I think what the prosecutor was trying to do, and it's hard, you know, looking at a cold record, trying to read the mind of why somebody's doing in the heat of trial what they do, is he was trying to sort of let the jury know Mr. Milburn knew about his rights, but he still opened his mouth and started yakking during that long drive back to Las Vegas. And that by doing that, and this sort of put it into context, because everybody, I wouldn't say everybody, but anybody that's watched more than about 5 hours of crime drama on television is somewhat aware of what the Miranda rights say. And so I think he was trying to diffuse an issue in the juror's mind of, well, did the officer Mirandize him? Even though, as we all know, there really wasn't a Miranda situation where a person starts making voluntary statements that are not the result of interrogation. So on that basis, I don't think, and then the prosecutor never touched on it again, never mentioned it again, and there was never anything beyond that little limited bit of trial where this issue ever arose. And on that basis, I would respectfully submit that there was not a Doyle error at all. But certainly, if there was Doyle error, then I think a Brecht analysis clearly shows there's not a substantial and injurious effect on the jury's verdict. Mr. Lambros raised an interesting analogy. He said if you're making spaghetti and you pour bleach on it, that would have a substantial and injurious effect on a jury's verdict. I think that's an incorrect standard using his analogy, because if you use his analogy, you put bleach on spaghetti, the spaghetti is ruined. You can't put a little bit of bleach on spaghetti. Basically, what Mr. Lambros' analogy is trying to do is make Brecht a structural error analysis. If you do anything to ruin the trial, you get a new one. I would suggest that if you want to use Mr. Lambros' spaghetti sauce analogy, the better example is adding too much salt. And whether that spaghetti sauce is still edible with a little bit too much salt in it. If you can taste the spaghetti sauce and it still tastes like edible spaghetti sauce, and something you can put on your spaghetti, then there hasn't been a substantial and injurious effect on the spaghetti sauce. On the other hand, if you dump a whole container of salt into the spaghetti sauce, making it totally inedible, then certainly there has been a substantial and injurious effect on the spaghetti sauce.
I have to admit, Mr. Neidert, that you've changed the analogy dramatically. When Mr. Lambros said that, I thought he said he added the leech. I didn't hear him say bleach, so I think I misunderstood that. It's changed my whole perception of the analogy, but thank you for clarifying that. So,
I heard bleach, and if he said leech, I apologize.
Well, we'll just have to get clarification on that on rebuttal, I'm sure. But.
I'm not sure putting a leech in there would make it totally inedible.
Well, that was where I was going with this.
But I think if you look at the evidence as a whole, yes, it was a circumstantial case, but I can't imagine what more circumstantial evidence you would want. You have the defendant in possession of the murder weapon. You have the defendant in possession of the victim's motor vehicle and the victim's car keys. You have the defendant calling the victim's family saying, "Have you seen the guy?" You have the defendant making up these incredible stories to law enforcement agents to try to create an alibi, saying the victim's going to sell cocaine and I want to give you a statement, and the law enforcement say, "Well, read the statement and sign it," whereupon our elusive Brian is not mentioned. And you have all of this and then Mr. Lambros saying, but the counter to that is, well, you have the pathologist. The trouble is that if you believe the defendant's story, which is rather hard to do given the number of times that he lied, he got the keys to the victim's motor vehicle on June 1st. That's what he said. He said this mysterious Brian gave him the keys and gave him the gun on June 1. So it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense with respect to that. And like I said, on the other hand, you have all of this evidence, including the testimony about how much the victim prized this Jeep, would not let anybody drive it. It was his baby. The contact with law enforcement and the victim's family to create an alibi, the gun in his possession. And that's not just beyond a reasonable doubt. That's overwhelming, overwhelming circumstantial evidence of Mr. Milburn's guilt. With respect to the second issue, the plea negotiation issues, I have two basic comments. First of all, I'm not aware of any case from the United States Supreme Court where it has held that if there is comment on plea negotiations, there is constitutional error. I'm not aware of a single case that says that. And under the AEDPA, for there to be habeas corpus relief, the complaint of conduct has to be contrary to or unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as established by the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Supreme Court has even said that means our holdings as opposed to our dicta. And the best that Mr. Lambros can cite with respect to this particular claim is Kershaval, which I don't think can be read at all to say that if there is a comment or about plea negotiations, there is constitutional error. That's my first comment with respect to this claim. My second comment with respect to this claim has to do with the nature of negotiations, just from a common sense standpoint. Negotiations, by common sense, indicate two people talking about something and trying to come to an agreement. In this case, there was no negotiations. In this case, Mr. Milburn was talking to a correctional officer. Nobody, including Mr. Milburn, I would suggest, would believe that that correctional officer had any standing or any ability to negotiate his case.
Ordinarily, it's where the defendant talks to an attorney on the other side or something.
Yeah, and I think that if you have a situation, it's correct, Your Honor, and I believe that if you have a situation where the attorneys get together and the attorney brings his client in and they all are sitting around a table and they're trying to negotiate the case and the prosecutor says, Mr. Defendant, tell me exactly what happened in this case. We see these scenes all the time on the television show Law and Order. I've never seen it happen in real life, but it does happen on television. And the defendant says, well, I did it. And then later on, the prosecutor rolled into court and says, you know what? He did it, and he said he did it, and he told it to me in a conference room. That's the kind of error where negotiations would come into play and where there's certainly a policy presumption against allowing that kind of evidence to come in. But that's not a situation where a prisoner in a detention facility goes to a correctional officer, I want to plead guilty. Now, the inference is that the jury is going to read that comment as saying, I am guilty. I did the crime. The problem with that is, as you pointed out, Judge Bybee, is if he'd said, I did it, I committed the crime, I put the body down the mine shaft, it's clear that that evidence would come in as an admission. What Mr. Lambros would argue is that what is allowable, if directly said, is disallowed if it's indirectly said. And I think that is the ultimate of exalting form over substance. So with respect, and finally I'd say with respect to that issue, that if in fact there is some Supreme Court decision for which I am unaware that makes it illegal or unconstitutional, to discuss plea negotiations, that certainly that would be subject to a Brecht analysis, and the same Brecht analysis would be applicable in this with respect to the other issue, in that the evidence in this case is just so compellingly strong against Mr. Milbourne that it did not have a substantial and injurious effect on the jury's verdict. So unless Your Honors have any question, I think that's what we're down to. We're down to two certified issues for which respondents respectfully suggest there is no constitutional error at all. But if this court were inclined to say that such error occurred, it clearly cannot, given this case, have had a substantial injurious effect on the verdict. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neidert. Mr. Lambrose? I really don't need you to address the analogy, but thank you anyway.
It was bleach that I saw.
Okay, good. It does clarify it in my mind. That's a much more powerful analogy than the one I thought you had offered us. So,
let me just begin by saying that the first that I've heard about whether or not the second question, the admission of the plea evidence, was a violation of clearly established laws, is from the podium today. If you look at the respondent's answering brief, they devote a total of 2 pages to the argument, and they don't make that argument. If they had made the argument, what I would have said in my reply brief is that there is circuit authority in this circuit, a case that I actually handled, and I'm sorry I don't have the cite, Robinson versus Ignacio, where this same issue came up, and what this court said was, you know, there does not have to be a direct, squarely on-point United States Supreme Court case if the logical extension of that Supreme Court case would be the kind of error that the petitioner is complaining about.
Okay, so where's the logical extension?
The logical extension is
Kercheval?
Is from Kercheval and Standen. Standen, again, stands for, and it's a Ninth Circuit case, and what Robinson says is that this court under AEDPA can look to Ninth Circuit precedent for the error if there can be some linkage.
The linkage's got to be pretty strong, but we need to have some anchoring Supreme Court decision that for you would be Kercheval. And that involved plea negotiations?
I believe it did. I'm sorry, I can't remember right now, but certainly Standen did.
Plea negotiations involving attorneys?
I don't know that. I'm sorry, Judge Biden.
Negotiations anyway.
I'm not positive about that. All I can say right now is that was the case that was, because in the Standen opinion, Standen, you know, in, as I recall, and that was also one of my cases, but it talked about how there was not a lot of authority for this type of error because it was so unique. I mean, introduction of a guilty plea.
Right. So is the state responsible for the officer's conduct in the jail? If he's just an unwilling recipient, he's not inviting this. He's not trying to get a promotion by getting a confession out of this guy. He's just standing there and maybe making some offhand comments to him. And all of a sudden, the guy says, "Call my lawyer. I want to plead guilty." And that makes the officer an agent of the DA's office for purposes of the negotiation?
Not an agent. The state is the proponent of the evidence. The state can or cannot choose to introduce that evidence. And as you know, if a prosecutor's first obligation is to ensure that justice is served, United States versus Berger, he shouldn't have proffered that evidence. I'm not saying that the correctional officer had any responsibility here, or that, you know, for that matter, he was an agent. But, you know, where the rubber meets the road is whether or not the proponent of the evidence should proffer the evidence. And I'm saying that evidence should not have been proffered because it was unconstitutional.
And it seems to me you push the Ninth Circuit precedents a little bit far when you speak of linkage. Edinburgh is pretty clear there has to be misapplication of a Supreme Court precedent. We go back to the Supreme Court. We don't try to tease it out precedent by precedent in the circuit. And if there's some language in some Ninth Circuit case that says that, it's a bit off base.
Right. But, again, you know, I would...
I know that we go back to the Supreme Court and say, what's the Supreme Court
precedent that's been misapplied.
Right, and that issue came up in Robinson. And again, I wish I would have had an opportunity to brief this. It's the first time I heard about it was right now. But I can tell you...
Well, you know what the AEDPA standard is.
Well, yeah, I know the standard is. And again, it's clearly established Supreme Court
authority.
As established by the Supreme Court. But in Robinson, petitioner invokes his Faretta, or invokes Faretta, goes Faretta, and then before sentencing, he wants his lawyer back. And the state court said, no, you can't have that, because once you've invoked, you've always invoked. Well, this court said, well, you know, Faretta may not directly say that you can reassert your right to counsel at sentencing, but come on. You know, there's linkage there. And that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that, you know, that Standen and Ninth Circuit precedent following Standen supports that conclusion, too. The only other thing, I think it might have been you, Judge Seiler, you were asking about whether or not there was a motion for mistrial. There was.
Yes.
And that's in the excerpts of record at pages 168 to 177.
State said that he thought there was, too.
Yeah. Other than that, unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lambros.
Thank you very much.
Milbourne will be submitted, and we will proceed to the next case, which is Boston Telecommunications Group versus Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu.